Thank you, Jason. Good morning, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. It has been a terrific weekend for me. I want to thank you guys for inviting me to be a part of Man to Man this year. And I've really had a great time. And I mean that from I know that that you guys have this every year. And what happens, you schedule three speakers, and they really only serve as kind of a framework to allow the rest of the weekend to happen. And allowed, I've had so many wonderful conversations with old friends and people that I just met this weekend, and I appreciate everyone who's made me feel so welcome and come and engaged me in conversation, and it's just been terrific. And so I leave here better for it. I thank you for that. I appreciate Bo and Bob and the talks they've given. They've two things you always wonder what to take away, and they've given wonderful talks, but of course, as they're talking, I'm always just thinking about when I get my turn to talk, and they model for me what this looks like. And what I've discovered from them is the 10-minute mark is when you can take your jacket off. And to your benefit, they both stopped exactly at an hour. I will get one of those, too. Should you see this jacket come off, you'll know about the other one. At any rate, it is a treat to be here, and I'm going to try to do what you've invited me to do and what our program suggests we do and share honestly about myself. That's kind of the value, I think, that we bring to Alcoholics Anonymous in our recovery, is the truth about ourselves. So I say I'm absolutely committed to being honest with you today, but I don't have the same commitment to accuracy. I'm often honestly mistaken and sometimes suffer from a past that never actually happened. And what I realize over time is that what I really do, you know, and that we talk about sharing, you know, what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. But I think that more accurately, I share with you what I think I was like. And I share with you the experience of what it was like. What I've realized is that in conversations with people in my life, that we went through many of the same circumstances and had a different experience. We recall it differently. We describe it differently. Just like looking at a piece of art or listening to a piece of music, that piece of art is exactly what it is, but we can have quite different experiences of it. And I know that how I see things is not always how they really were. That's part of that. That's part of that being spiritually awakened and being able to see things as they really were. I know that a number of years ago, I was my wife Connie was with me. I spoke at a conference. We went up that evening to our hotel room, and she said, "Steve," she said, "you know that last 15 minutes or so of your talk?" And I'd given just a stellar talk, so I said, "Yeah, baby." And she said, "I would love to meet that guy." I wish you would bring him home sometime. And so I know that literally and figuratively, how I see me is not always how other people see me. And how I see you is never the whole picture. Yet I make life-changing, life-altering decisions based on bad information that's funneled through the prism of self, of self-centeredness, and it comes out and it is influenced by pride, it is influenced by fear, it is influenced by lust and jealousy and envy and all of those seven deadly sins and all the other variations of that, all those common manifestations of self that when I show up here color my experience of life, drunk or sober. In fact, drunk, I can explain anything I ever did when I was drinking. You know, I was drunk. You know, I mean, after I drink, my behavior is drunken behavior. And you take a fifth of whiskey and pour it in me, and a fifth of whiskey and pour it in a non-alcoholic, and we're both going to be drunk, and we're both going to do drunk stuff. And it's not necessarily the way I drink and my relationship with alcohol is alcoholic. But the effect that alcohol has upon me in terms of once I get drunk, that's drunken behavior. You know, I got 6 DUIs, and my mother, at a certain point, my mother had said, you know, at about number 2, she said, and I said, you know, I'm not going to drink and drive anymore. I mean, that seems like the solution to drunk driving, is that the choice I came to says, I will not drink and drive, you know, or drive and drink. I mean, whichever one of those I start first, I won't do the other one. And then I get this other deal. My mother said, I thought you weren't going to drink and drive. And I said, I wasn't, Mama. But then I got drunk. When I get drunk, I change my mind about stuff. When I get drunk, I do drunk stuff. It impairs my decision making. It influences the choices I make. It overrides my intellect and my common sense and all of that. And it looks like I got the kind of alcoholism that you guys have talked about all weekend. But to my mother, I'm sure, I forgot who it was yesterday in one of the workshops that says that so many of us don't read, you know, to the wives and to the employer and family afterward. Well, I have, but one of my favorite lines is into the employer. And it says, when dealing with an alcoholic, there may be a natural annoyance that someone could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. Because to the untrained eye, alcoholism looks weak, stupid, and irresponsible. It looks like if you loved me enough, you wouldn't do that. You're a bright guy. Why do you do that? And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only people calling me alcoholic were judges and lawyers and policemen. My family wasn't trying to get me to stop drinking. My wife wasn't trying to get me to stop drinking. They wanted me to drink less often. They wanted me to not drink as much of it. They wanted me to not drink it there. They wanted me to not drink it with them. They wanted me to not drink it tonight. They didn't want me to stop drinking. They just didn't want all the stuff that happened when I drank, you know. They wanted me to do what we suggest here. They wanted me to find a way to control and enjoy my drinking. They had the same great obsession that I had, that one day I would control and enjoy it. And control and enjoy on me, in my experience, doesn't mean not get drunk. I mean, I never tried to drink just enough to know I'd not been, you know, to feel like I'd not been drinking. I want to feel differently after I drink than before I drink. So just enough is enough to get everything alcohol does for me without suffering any of the pains of what it began to do to me. Because I never once took a drink hoping. You know, open that bottle and hoping if I do everything just right, you know, around 12 or 1 o'clock this evening, I'll have pissed my pants, be locked up in the back of a police car, cheated on my wife on the way to jail. You know, let's get this party started. That was never my plan. Our book talks about what most normal folks get from a few drinks. That's what I want. Back in the vision for you. There were some, I know that I'm so glad to see some of the newer people here last night, and I almost hate to do this to you. But for most normal folks, it says drinking means conviviality, joyous intimacy with friends, colorful imagination, release from care, boredom, and worry, and a feeling that life is good. Yeah, I just got a little thirsty saying that. That's an attractive package. And that's what most normal folks, maybe that guy that goes home and you know, has a couple of beers, smokes half a joint, gets in his recliner and, you know, watches Andy Griffith reruns or something. And he gets that, you know, relaxed moment and kicks back and maybe some, a couple of his buddies come over and they tell the same stories they told last Tuesday to each other, but that's, you know, and that's okay. But that's nice. It's not so for those of us, and in this case, that's not what happened to me in the latter days of my drinking. Maybe momentarily, right? Maybe, I don't know, I go out, and maybe in the early part of the evening, and first few drinks, I get that vibe. Yeah, I get, yeah, this is better. And it says, but then comes oblivion and awakening to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. You know, and I was just looking for a little joyous intimacy with friends, and I wake up with these four bedfellows. And where did you guys come from, and where's the blonde that was here a while ago, you know? Turns out she wasn't blonde, and she wasn't even her. And so all of this, you know, that's what this looked like on me. That's what this looked like on me. My sobriety date's June the 30th of 1989, and on July the 1st of 1989, I was going to go to a treatment facility, and not because I had decided I was going to stop drinking. Not even because I decided, and I certainly didn't want to stop drinking. I knew that I had alcohol-related problems. I mean, I was bright enough to be able to connect the dots between, you know, you to get a DUI, you got to be drunk, you know. I was in a meeting with a guy one night, a newcomer, and it was a beginner's meeting, and I noticed I hadn't met him before. I introduced myself. We're talking a minute. He clearly wasn't happy to be at the meeting, and I understand that. And I said, "What brings you here, man?" He said, "I got a DUI for having a broken tail light." Yeah. I know, man. I get it. I said, but my guess is you were drinking at the time. And but that's the way I thought. I knew I had alcohol-related problems. I could trace back to my drinking. But why can't I? Because I think, not only do other people think that I'm weak, stupid, and irresponsible, I think I'm weak, stupid, and irresponsible. And I think I can overcome that with firm resolve and good intentions. I'll try harder. I want to. I don't want to hurt the people I'm hurting. I don't want to cause some of the damage and carnage in my family and in my work life and with my friends that I'm causing. I don't want to be arrested. I don't want to do a lot of the things I've done. So I'm going to try harder. And I'm going to do better. And that looks like a noble and appropriate approach to alcoholism, like I've got it. And I don't know that I can't do that. I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys begin to give me language to describe what had been going on with me in a way that I didn't have words. You know, how often do I, and perhaps you guys go, "I don't know." You know, people say, "Steve, why would you do that? How could you do that again?" I don't know. You know, in our book, when it says that when we asked that guy how he could have gone out on that bender again, and it says, and we kind of laugh at the line all the time, it says, once in a while he may tell the truth. And the reason that he tells the truth once in a while is because he's just throwing shit against the wall. And every now and then it's the truth by accident because he's trying to figure out what did happen. I don't know. Because I don't understand, I get here, and you guys start using language. You know, you suggest that if I'm an alcoholic, the way Alcoholics Anonymous describes one, that I've got an allergy to alcohol, that I respond differently, and I didn't. That was huge information to me. Right? When our book says that, you know, the doctor's theory that we had an allergy interests us, it explained that for which we could not otherwise account. That's what interested me. Oh, an allergy. So it's not just that I'm weak, stupid, and irresponsible. But it feels weak, stupid, and irresponsible. I'm headed to that treatment center not because I want to stop drinking, but for legal compliance, for the conviction of my sixth DUI a year before. And we'd worked out a plea bargain agreement that was giving me some jail time and giving me some taking some of that jail time off if I would go to residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And I'm going just to do my time. And I'm always embarrassed at this part of my story. I'm also, you know, I've been around here listening to some of y'all's tales, and this is really a rough and tumble bunch. In fact, it just dawned on me a minute ago as those knives were being handed out. Yeah. At first it concerned me because now about a third of the crowd is armed. But then I realized everybody who picked up a knife now is carrying two knives. You showed up armed. And I'm just kind of, I'm not a tough guy, and I'm not a street smart guy, and I'm just kind of the poster boy for middle class alcoholism, and so I've heard your stories this week, so when I have to tell you that my last drink was an amaretto on the rocks, that is no way to go down in Alcoholics Anonymous. Usually identification when alcoholic with another is the real linchpin of AA, but I've never had one person come up in that line later and go, me too, man, thank God somebody told my story, you know? But see, I wasn't planning, what you now know is I didn't know it was going to be my last drink. I would have gone down more colorfully than that, and particularly had I thought I would be telling the story regularly, I would have been sucking off the neck of a vodka bottle. I would have gone down and crashed and burned in flames and risen like a phoenix from the ashes and be telling you a story here that would bring a tear to your eye. But now I just got this, you know, weeny little story I'm going to tell. I used to tell a different story. I did. It was fascinating, you know. It wasn't very useful, but it was fascinating. But I see in our book when it says that we tell the new man exactly what happened to us. And so for me to hide from something that did happen and not share it with you or make up something that didn't happen is not useful. My story will land where it's supposed to land. It'll land on who it's supposed to land on. That's why we all tell our stories to one another. Sometimes we do it from the podium, but we do it more often and usually more effectively. In the cafeteria or coffee after the meeting or one-on-one or in our home group. And ultimately, we just tell the truth about ourselves. And that helps who it's supposed to help. So I'm going to try to do that, you know. My buddy Ricky came over on July the 1st of 1989 to drive me off to treatment. My wife followed us out to the car, my wife Connie. Connie and I had been married 7 years at the time, and we had met in a bar. She couldn't have been more attractive to me. She just showed up freshly divorced from Lake Tahoe in a pickup truck, an 8-ball of cocaine, and a pocket full of divorce money. And you can't pass on that picture. We started running and gunning together. We had troubles. We had troubles in that marriage. I mean, we went to Mexico. We weren't married. We went to Mexico a year later on a vacation, and we'd been living together. We got drunk, got on a boat, went out to international waters where an Austrian captain read a wedding ceremony in Spanish, so he said. We don't speak Spanish, so we're not sure what we agreed to that day. I can tell you what wasn't in the ceremony. Apparently, there was nothing about love, honor, and obey. But you know, we had good times. We had hard times. We were navigating through that. We had a daughter during those 7 years that was 5 years old that morning that I was headed off. Connie was running and gunning just like me, but we always weren't doing it together, and I wasn't always as good a husband as I should have been, or a father, and I wasn't as trustworthy as I should have been and could have been. And I didn't know what being married was about. I didn't know I was, just to clear one thing up, while being weak, stupid, and irresponsible is not necessarily an alcoholic trait, you can be alcoholic and weak, stupid, and irresponsible. And apparently I fit both descriptions. And I was an immature, I just didn't know how to be a husband, I didn't know how to be a father, and I wasn't willing, and maybe I wasn't willing, I don't know. But she walked out to the car that day when we were getting relieved, and her last words to me were, "No matter what, baby, don't stop drinking." Yeah, I know a lot of you didn't get that kind of support, but but that Connie's rock solid, and go do your time, come back, and it's back on, because we didn't know another way to live. And my buddy Ricky drove me off, and I got there, and he let me off, and I went in, and the first thing they did was give what they called an assessment. Right? It felt like a test to me. It was harder than my ACTs, and they changed a little bit over the years, and today they're a little more clinically driven, a little more medically necessity driven to help qualify for insurance reimbursement and things like that. But the test then was the assessment was a little more like, you know, Jeff Foxworthy's "You Might Be a Redneck If" test, and they asked a bunch of questions, and they said, "Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking?" There were 30 "have you ever" questions. And they said, they explained with some emphasis that "have you ever" means even once, and even with a really good reason. Have you ever? And then they have just check yes or check no to what are clearly essay questions. I mean, you've tried to answer some of it, you know. Have you been drinking? Well, you know, there's a story. And and we'll laugh here this morning, and that's a good thing. Our book says that cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. But most of you know, and if you're new, I want you to know that none of this was funny while it was happening, man. What happens is I get to stand here today and look back at the absurdity of my life as I was living it. I get to look at that and go, "Are you kidding me?" I get to look and be just like our book says, that at that point I was right in the middle of that guy who could not differentiate the true from the false, that my alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. And today I go, how could that have ever looked normal? How could this have ever looked normal? But somehow all I know is how to try to navigate and make this life work, that this tacky, tawdry life that I'm in the middle of it, how do I keep trying to tweak it up and hold it together and tape it up and keep going? Because I don't know how to make it different. I don't know how to have a conversion experience that you would later talk to me about here. I don't know how to have a psychic change. I'm going to try harder. And the try harder is to get that stuff, not only that I need from alcohol, that relief that was talked about, That release from selfishness and that self-obsession, that self, just me being all over me, the insecurity, the fear that I felt. Now, I couldn't have put any of these labels on that. I walked around feeling a way that I couldn't describe how I felt. And you certainly know, I don't talk to anybody about this. I'm living a life scared to death. I'm a freshman in college. Just a couple of thoughts came to me this weekend that I don't usually talk about. It wasn't a big deal, but as a freshman in college, I went to my very first class, and I get a little lost on campus, and I can't find my way to the class. And I arrive at the class about 10 or 15 minutes late, and the door is closed. It's got a little, you know, little square glass window there, and I peek in, and the class is in there, and the professor's in there, and I can't go in. I now can't make myself go in because I'm embarrassed. And so I just never go back to class. I don't withdraw from the class. Bob made me think about it last, you know, in his talk. I just can't go back to that class. I couldn't. And by the way, when I'm walking around the campus, I can't ask anybody where the class is. I don't know why that is. I can't explain that, and I'm not telling anybody that. But that's how I felt. And I wasn't drinking then. I didn't take a drink until later that, you know, once you can't get to class, you probably need to start drinking. Something needs to change. I needed some relief, but I don't know what's going on there. Anyway, they gave me that test, and the problem with that test is one of the problems is I think I know what they're asking, right? How often have I gone through life thinking I understand what's going on and making these life-changing decisions based on bad information? Have you ever drank in the morning? You know, I had questions about the questions. Let's clarify, what do you mean morning? And the reason I say it is because I think that they're asking me, if I'm that guy that's got to reach over on the nightstand and grab that half pint and take a pull off of it just to get, you know, to the bathroom, just to get my day started at 4 in the morning to fight off the shakes. And I've done that a couple times, but not so often I'm going to mark it on this test. And because that was an aberration. But what if I'm out at 2 a.m. somewhere at last call at a very nice establishment? Is that morning drinking? And if I just check yes, you're not going to understand the difference in me and him. If I don't give you context for this answer, if I don't give you background information, you know, have you ever drank alone? You know, yeah, but they left. I mean... I mean, whoa, you know, where did everybody go? I mean, it was a party just a little while ago. But again, I think I know what they're asking, right? I think they're asking if I'm that guy that's got to go home and close the door and pull the shades. And, used to be unplug the phone, now just put it on silent or turn it off and kind of hide from the world, drink in isolation. You know, and I've done that a few times, but not so often I'm checking it on that tab. And there's another kind of alone drinking that I did that to me, you can't call this alone drinking, can you? I mean, I'm a guy that had to drink to go drinking. You know, you got to have a few drinks at home as you get ready to go where you're going to drink, because you got to show up ready to play. I needed what our book calls using alcohol as a social lubricant. And to me, that's very descriptive. It is literally, I was like being home, it might as well be oiling up. So I can move easily amongst you. And without that, I feel like I'm bumping into everything. And that's the way I felt sober in any kind of social or work or family interaction. But here's the interesting thing, at least to me. I don't think I looked like a guy that felt like that. I don't think anybody in my life close to me would have described me as shy and insecure and feeling awkward and easily embarrassed or any of those things, because my whole job was not to be caught looking like a guy that felt that way. And man, that is hard work. That's exhausting work for a guy like me. So drinking makes that so much easier. Drinking would wash away that self-consciousness, that hyper self-consciousness. You know, when the book says that we alcoholics are sensitive people, it was several years before I realized that's not a compliment. Yeah. And there's a hint, really, that it's not, because the next line describes it as a devastating handicap. I was handicapped by this hypersensitivity. That, again, I got no language to describe this. I don't know. I just know that, I'm not comfortable going in there. But I'm a guy that's got to look like he looks comfortable. So I overcome that, but it's exhausting. So that requires a lot of time alone, too. And that requires a lot of drinking to let that guard down. I know what it's like to stand in front of that door and steel myself up to get ready to go in and then show up and do my thing. And that can be at work. That can be at home. That can be social. And I got to tell you, and that can happen any day right now. Still got days that it pops up where life is hard when I'm feeling me all over me all day long. That's a long day. Now, what you guys told me, how I didn't do well on the test. The other one is, are you a blackout drinker? Right now, I am a blackout drinker. I don't know that you have to be a blackout drinker to be alcoholic or anything, but I happen to be a blackout drinker, you know. And I love the comedian Dave Attell said he's a blackout drinker, or as he likes to call it, time travel. And I thought, I get that, right? You know, how did I get here in the future, and what has been going on? And I've spent many times, perhaps some of you, but you don't ask those questions, right? You read people's faces the next day. You know, was I just kind of cute last night, or did this go way off in the weeds? And you're just looking at people and thinking they're thinking, and it's you know. So you guys let me know right away that how I answered the questions on that test isn't what makes me alcoholic or not alcoholic. Those are indicators. They may shine a light on my alcoholism. They may be a red flag to alcoholism. But the description that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me, that I could finally lay my life experience over and go, that fits me, and it took a little while, was that, you know, if you, when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop entirely. And if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. That's kind of an innocuous little statement when it throws out, you know, you're probably alcoholic. Yeah. You know, I mean, we're pretty sure you're alcoholic, but go with what makes you comfortable, Steve. And I began to get where I could lay that life experience and confirm that, because there were times I was going to quit entirely. And to be fair, that entirely was hardly ever forever, but there were times I was going to quit for self-imposed periods of time. I'm going to quit for a month until, you know, the heat's off. That last DUI I got, they gave me that year's probation. They said if you get any alcohol-related offense during this year, you'll go to jail for a year, no questions asked. So I was going to not drink for a year simply to avoid the ramifications and the legal ramifications that would come if I got a DUI or got an offense. And I was leaving the courthouse that day after just being given this news and after just arriving at this firm resolution not to drink for a year. And I was walking to my car. I sometimes say I just parked too far from the courthouse. As I'm walking to my car, I began to rethink that. And I said, well, wait a minute. My problem is driving and drinking. And that's when I came up with the I won't drink and drive or drive and drink. You know, I'm firmly committed to this. But I'm still walking to my car, and I'm still thinking, and I came up with one more slight change to that. I said, I won't drink much when I drive. And I know that I'm not in charge of not being able, I know I can't decide not to drink much. I don't know that then. So when you get here, that allergy explained that for which I couldn't otherwise account. So anyway, I'm in that treatment center, and we began to go out to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs, and people brought them in, and I'm grateful for all of them. And I was trying real hard not to be alcoholic. I described myself when I introduced myself. I introduced myself as a problem drinker. I decided I was willing to have an alcohol-related problem. But as I listened, as I came to AA, and you guys began to share your stories and share that language, and you would say something, and the moment you said it, I'd go, oh, that's it. And you began to use phrases. You told me about the allergy, and that was comforting, to be honest with you. That made some sense. You started talking about this mental obsession. You started talking about this phenomenon of craving. That's kind of a cool term, you know, I didn't know that before I got to AA. I mean, I was never out at the bar, and after about my second or third drink, you know, just nudged the guy next to me. So, I don't know about you, pal, but that phenomenon of craving's kicking in on me. Lack of power is my dilemma. I didn't know, you know. I just thought I changed my mind. So now I'm getting that. You guys are describing this and describing it in your experience in a way that I'm going, yeah, man, that hits home. That resonates with me. What I know is, and it's interesting, and it wasn't an intellectual thing. I got information that I had never heard before that was interesting and really useful. But I know that language of the heart, that the message you were sharing of depth and weight resonated at a level other than the intellectual. It was hitting something in here where there was a knowing. Go, oh, man, that's it. That's it. And I couldn't have said it a minute before. I'll tell you a couple drinking stories, and I'll be sober for the next hour and 15 minutes. Those of you with 3 o'clock flights may want to rebook. Because I want you to think that amaretto is the only drink I had. I also had some Boone's Farm wine. And strap in, it gets ugly now. But that was my first drink. I didn't take a drink till I was a freshman in college, and two buddies came by and they picked me up, and we were. I wasn't going to be a drinker. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a moral decision or anything. I just wasn't going to be a drinker. I was playing athletics. I was a good kid. I behaved myself. I was a kid that colored inside the lines. I went where I said I was going to go. I was with who I said I was going to be with, and I came home when I said I was going to come home. I was a rebel trapped in a good kid's body. I wanted to do that other stuff, but I was afraid. I was afraid to be the rebel. And these guys came over. We're going back to high school basketball game. They handed back a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine. We started drinking that a little bit, and I got free of that self-consciousness. I said, all of a sudden, I was in the back seat of a 1968 yellow Volkswagen Bug, and all of a sudden, the back seat of that Volkswagen couldn't hold me. I was ready to spring myself on an unsuspecting world, and I thought you couldn't. I couldn't wait to get where we were going because I thought you couldn't wait to see me when I got there. And I had a wonder to my memory. I had a wonderful evening. I was free in a way that I had never, that I don't recall being before. I'm sure as a little kid I experienced that same lack of self-consciousness at times. But anyway, so I started, I don't know if I was alcoholic before I took that drink, and I don't know if I was alcoholic right after I took that drink. And I don't even know if I drank alcoholically right after that drink because I drank so enthusiastically. And it is impossible to know whether you can moderate your drinking if you're not trying to moderate it. It is impossible to know whether you can stop drinking entirely if you're not trying to stop drinking. So I wasn't managing my drinking at all at that point. I drank whenever I wanted to. And I got a progressive disease. And usually that want to started on kind of Thursdays and through the college weekend. And then pretty soon, in this progressive nature, it gained steam and it became, just a regular part of my life. And accessorizing that over time with a whole variety of other drugs and stuff that was going on. And I was just all in, but it looked a lot like, it looked a lot like everybody else in school. I mean, this looked like a college party to me. But other people began to grow out of this, and other people began to grow up and move on, and I wasn't. I was going the other way. I couldn't measure it. I didn't see it for that, but I'm progressing in my alcoholism while other people are starting to put away childish things. And they're starting to be husbands and fathers and workers and people in the community. And I'm still the guy that's just, running the streets and anyway, just stupid, weak, and irresponsible on the surface. I moved to Florida. I started going to work in a family business. Bob told so much of my story last night and told it so much more eloquently, but I was a salesman who couldn't make sales calls. And I would drive to little rural towns in Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, and I was at the time supposed to be selling furniture. You go in, they had most little towns like that, the guys my age will know, had two furniture stores on the square right there, and usually they were, mom and pop owned, and I'd pull into a town and park and not be able to go in. And I would sit there and not go in, and then I would drive to the other store and sit there and not go in. And then I would end up driving to a little, you know, motor lodge and checking in for the night and start drinking and smoking dope there overnight. And I got to call my, I'm going to do better tomorrow. And you know, different times and not cell phones and email and everything. I got to call in at the end of the day. I worked for my brother who was only 4 years older than me. My dad had died and he took over this family business. And I think he's treating me poorly and overly demanding and a jerk. I said for 18 years into my sobriety, I blame my brother for so much. And I said he was the most complicated relationship in my life. And I told people about the complications. And I was 18 years sober before I realized I was the complication. And I held him prisoner in ways that he didn't deserve for some things that we were both kids trying to find our way up through in a man's world when we were just kids. And I certainly was ill-equipped. But I ran off to Florida, took a job down there that I also didn't do. But if you keep moving, you can stay a step ahead of them. I totaled out a car, company car down there. I hung out down there till they knew I wasn't working. Then I left ahead of getting fired. I came back to work for my brother. For years I worked for him when he didn't know what to do with me because I wasn't working. I mean, I'd get up in the morning. Connie and I, after we got married, we lived in New Orleans. And she just, you know, she hated the way I would get up and shower and put on a coat and tie, look like this, grab a briefcase and leave our little apartment. And then she had a job at 10 a.m. that she would go to, and I would come back after she left at 10 o'clock and stay in the apartment all day. And then I would leave before she was coming home and go back out, and then I'd come in. I'd have that coat off, hung over my shoulder, my sleeves rolled up, my tie undone. It's been tough out there today, baby, you know, playing grown up, and I can't do it. I'd go to shopping malls and just walk around. I'd go to movies and hide out in movies. And feeling like everybody who saw me knew what I was doing and what I wasn't doing. Feeling like a fraud all the time. The phone would ring. It would be my brother calling our apartment. I'd make my wife take that call and lie to him, or I'd make her not answer it. Now, my brother's no dummy. You know, when your friends call and the phone rings 3, 4, 5, 7 times, nobody's home. They hang up. When that phone rings 45, 50 times, that's my brother going, "I know you're there." And now you know I know you're there. Anyway, we moved back to Nashville, I'd been in Fort Lauderdale. I moved to Atlanta. In Atlanta, I left a bar one afternoon. I'd been drinking kamikaze shooters and taking Tylenols, and I got on the I-285 interstate perimeter of Atlanta going east into westbound lane. I hit a car head on and two other cars hit us. It totaled all four cars. It sent people to the hospital. It sent me to jail. Woke up, came to in jail the next morning. Fuzzy recollection of what had happened. I'd urinated on myself. I'd vomited on myself. Or, you know, I hope I did because somebody did. I prefer to think that's an indignity I inflicted on myself. But I decided to quit drinking. I'm done. This is 1980. I've crossed a line even I can't live with. I had never been more afraid of the consequences, legal, personal, professional. I've never been more ashamed of what I'd done and the harm I'd caused, and I didn't yet know the extent of the injuries of people. It turned out they weren't fatal, but I got sued over it. There were some people that were hurt. I had never been more humiliated at the state I found myself in, my own urine and my own vomit in this drunk tank where I don't belong. Somehow, I'm visiting the zoo, but I don't think I'm one of the animals, you know. And I said, I'm done. And 10 days later, I'm driving down the road, smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, thinking I nearly overreacted to this thing. And that's the alcoholism I got. And then I get to AA, and I find in our book where it says that there'll come a time that a guy like me, an alcoholic, won't be able to bring the consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'll be without defense against the dream. My own personal history tells me that you can't scare me sober. You can't strip enough of my integrity away to get me sober. You can't induce me to stay sober through promotions and money. You can't love me enough to keep me sober. All those things might make a guy like me be willing to do what it takes to get sober. But of the firm resolve just to avoid those things or keep those things, they're insufficient. What I can measure, I've only got the one experience, but what I can measure is a head-on collision going the wrong way down the interstate will get me 10 days of sobriety. And that's a pretty heavy price to pay for 10 days. What you guys helped me see after I got here was I was aiming at the wrong target. That firm resolve, those good intentions, have me coming at my problem, trying to solve my alcoholism, and really what I'm trying to solve is my drinking problem. And it looks like the solution to a drinking problem is not drinking. It looks like the treatment for alcoholism is to not drink. And not drinking isn't the treatment for alcoholism, it's the preparation for the treatment for alcoholism. You guys told me, I'm coming at this, Steve, you're fighting your problem, but you don't have the necessary power. So don't fight your problem. Turn away from the problem and seek the solution. So quit trying to overwhelm your alcoholism and start trying to build a relationship with God. Try to plug into this power which will solve your problem. I'm getting kind of attracted to AA. I'm going out to meetings. I'm digging it. You're an exciting group of people. You know, you tell colorful stories. We're kind of, you know, this is not a Mensa class here for sure. And so I thought, hey, I can run with this pack, you know. And that was all kind of cool, but I didn't know much about what was going to be expected and what you were talking about. And I'm listening, and all of a sudden I say, I got this alcoholism thing. Not only do I have it, I'm kind of now excited about having it. You guys have it, I got it. We're on the same team. I'm in the club. We're a gang now. So I'm in, man. And the next line in that book says, if so, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. Damn. Now I got a problem. I got a dilemma, as our book describes it. I've got the dilemma that Bill had initially when Abby came and he says, I got religion. You know, because he's looking at Abby, clear-eyed, clear-skinned, got a different look on him. It was, Abby, man, what came over you, brother? What's up? Got religion, Bill. Oh, Bill was aghast. Damn. Anybody getting that look another way, man? Yeah. What are the other boys doing down there, you know? Nah, we're all on this kick, man. So I got this dilemma. I got a problem I can't solve, and you're offering me a solution I don't want. A dilemma is a problem with two equally unsatisfactory solutions. We describe it, right? Whether to accept spiritual help or go on to the bitter end. Whether to die an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. I got to pick, and I'm not excited about either choice. Because I don't know, because I'm not on this, you know, as we hear the language we use. But what about the God thing, man? I got a problem with the God thing. And I had a problem with the God thing. I wouldn't hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. I'd step back from the circle. Guy came to me and said, Steve, what's that all about, man? You know, and I said, well, and I was earnest. I was misguided, but I was earnest. And I said, man, I don't want to be a hypocrite, you know. I don't know what I believe. And this guy had heard my treatment fifth step, you know, that my confessional, if you will, of all the stuff I could muster up at the time. He knew there'd been infidelities in my marriage. He knew about this head-on collision. He knew I'd been drunk at the hospital making a scene when my daughter was born. He knew I'd stolen time and money from a family business. He said, but hypocrisy, that's where you draw the line, huh? He He said, man, I got good news for you and bad news for you, Steve. And I felt kind of condescended to, and if you knew, if you've ever felt condescended to, it's because you've just been condescended to. And he said, I got good news for you and bad news. I said, all right, man, I'll play. I said, you know, what's the bad news? He said, the bad news is hypocrisy is way down your list of problems. And you might ought to address them in the order in which they will kill your ass. I said, what's the good news? You know. He said, the good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, and that's as good a news for me today as it was then, believe me. Yeah, man, we've got an opening. We've got one of our hypocrites left just yesterday. So, you know, he just gave me permission to move in a little bit and just kind of move on, if you will. And I got out. I went and went to the 202 Club, the Friendship House there in Nashville, and I went upstairs and fell in with some people that really changed my life. And not through information, though they provided a bunch of it. But they were just people that, to me, made Alcoholics Anonymous look attractive. And different people are attracted by different things, because this was a pretty rough and tumble crowd, but the guy that would become my sponsor, Frank, was in there. Frank had spent some time, Frank would almost always say that he got sober August 9, 1979 in a detox hospital in Topeka, Kansas. But his next move was he came to Dallas, Texas. He came to the Preston Group in Dallas. He said, I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I didn't like them mothers. So he stayed just long enough to help you folks in the Preston Group, and then he came on to Nashville, and I ran into Frank, and he was a big man. He was a character. But he was like 6'5", about 280, and big personality, and not afraid to use it. Said he didn't suffer fools well, and he often saw fools where there weren't any. He helped a lot of people didn't need helping sometimes. But he was just the right fit for me. And that's what I hope for any of us, that we just find the right fit for us. It's just like Dave was talking yesterday, man. It's not about the perfect AA member. It's not about that stuff. But can I find somebody that can lead me into this? And Frank was the right guy for me at the right time. And I loved AA right away. I mean, I don't know if I loved the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved hanging out with you guys, and I was fascinated. And, Frank, we started doing some step work. And about 6 months sober, I had a realization. At 6 months sober, you guys, I sat there and I was coming back. It was the week after Thanksgiving, the Monday after Thanksgiving. I'm sitting in a meeting, and people are talking to each other. And that's the first I realized that you guys were kind of talking to each other between meetings sometimes, that you were having relationships, that stuff was going on. And at the end of the meeting, I'm sure it had been said before, but somebody said something to the effect, it was a noontime meeting, said, we're all going to lunch after the meeting if anybody wants to go. I desperately wanted to go, desperately. And I got in my car and headed over to the Shoney's where they were going to be going, and about halfway there I pulled off and went home. And the next week, same thing, pulled off and went home. Did that about 3 weeks, and I desperately wanted to go. But I had a fear, and my fear was that I was going to walk into that Shoney's and there would already be six people sitting at a table for six. And I didn't know whether I'm supposed to pull a seventh chair up, whether they really meant me, whether it was going to inconvenience. I was too self-conscious to risk this awkward moment and be embarrassed, you know. Well, Lyle P. says that we'd rather be dead than embarrassed. And I said, all I needed was a couple of guys to come up to me after the meeting and go, hey, Steve, man, we really want you to go to lunch with us. And we're just arguing over who gets to sit with you. Then I would have gone. Now, I want to tell you, and I know this is true. I know that there's some people here who've maybe never been here before, and maybe a couple of guys that come that don't know a lot of other people, and you've gotten your tray of food in there this weekend, and then you're kind of wandering around wondering where to sit. Do I go sit with these? Here's three guys over here. Do I go sit here? I don't know. I don't know them. What are they going to think? What are you doing over here, man? That's the way my brain works. Whoa, not you, man. Look, this is the cool kids' table. As if there could be one here. But I know that feeling, man. I still get that feeling. I know that. And what I would tell you newer folks is when they say, let's go to lunch, man, go. If you see me sitting at the table, come sit next to me. Because I'm still afraid to come sit next to you. So come do it. No. Let's be freer of that bondage of self. And sometimes I got to risk it a little bit because we mean it. We hold each other up here at our best. And then we all have some down days where I'm the guy that needs being held up. Trust me. Well, I just got a few minutes left and figure out how I want to use it. Connie, we navigated through stuff again. I listened to Bob last night at 10 years sober. And Connie got sober, just so you know. I sometimes forget to mention. Her sobriety date's 10 days after mine. And she's an active, wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, an effective member. Her activity looks far different than my activity. But Connie sponsors women. She does 2 book studies a week in our home. That's how she sponsors women. If Connie sponsors you, you're coming over and they're going through the book together. That's what they do. That's not what I do. I had one of the guys I sponsor one night call the house, and I picked up the phone. I mean, he called out. This was back when we still had a landline, and I picked up the phone, and I'm talking to him, and we're talking for a few minutes, but I'm wondering, why aren't you getting to what you want? And finally he went, Steve, could I talk to Connie? But Connie and I are rocking along. At a year sober, we moved to Richmond, Virginia for 7 years. I could talk about the wonderful experience we had there and the sponsorship I had there. We came back to Nashville. At 10 years sober, we went bankrupt. And as Connie would say, I went bankrupt and took her with me. But and we had some tough times around that. And remember, they came by. We lost our home. They came by to flatbed truck loaded up our cars. You know, they call that surrendering them in a bankruptcy, but it felt like a kidnapping to me, you know. But I called Frank. I said, man, Frank, that, you know, they took our cars. And we knew, we had scheduled it. We knew it was coming. But I made calls. I said, man, they took our cars today. He went, no, Steve, they took their cars. Just to put a fine point on, and he said, those are the cars you quit paying for. You know? And we went and got a car. A guy who was in the car business invited us out to his used car dealership. It was a GM dealership, and he helped us get a car that we couldn't afford, but it was about a 10-year-old used car. It was a green Chevy Lumina with kind of velour cloth seats that had stains on it that I didn't make. And but I will tell you, Connie and I left that dealership, and we were driving home. And Connie just wears her heart on her sleeve, and she was weeping in gratitude. And so happy and grateful to have this car. And as was I, because when she weeps, I end up kind of weeping with her, and we're doing that. And we are seriously heartfelt grateful to have this car. And about 10 days later, 10 days, 2 weeks, I'm driving down the road in this piece of shit green Chevy Lumina. And that's how quickly my life. And so what I know, I mean, and I'd say that, you guys know this, but that's the prism with which I view life. That car was the same car, but for the 4 years that I drove that car, it was like 2 different cars, depending on the me that got in it that day. And that's true in my relationships. That's true in my work life. when it's the me that is showing up at this. The next two things I'm going to say seem to have nothing to do with anything else I've talked about, but it matches up. It's important to me on that theme, if you will, because see, what I don't realize is I go through life with these unmet demands that I don't even know I have. Our 12 and 12 says that we will see we've been making unreasonable demands upon our fellows, upon ourselves, and upon God. You know, if you're keeping score, that's everybody. There's no one left for me to be unreasonably demanding of. You disappoint me, I disappoint me, God disappoints me. And it says, living this life of unmet demands will leave me in a state of continual disturbance. And this isn't about having our demands met, it's about lessening our demands. It's about being freer of that bondage of self, so I'm more and more okay with things the way they are. So I go to it's now been about 13, 14 years ago, I go to Toronto to a little one-day thing, and I'm the guy behind the podium all day long there. I know that you guys are grateful that this is just an hour and plus. And I've been laying the knowledge on them, brother. I've been putting, they were speaking in tongues, and we break for lunch. And at lunch, we're at different tables, obviously, but I mean, we're at a little restaurant, and they come take our order. And I ordered a cheeseburger, and the guy next to me ordered a club sandwich, I noticed, and I went on around. A little while later, they brought our food, and they gave me a cheeseburger, and they gave the guy next to me a cheeseburger. And he starts eating his cheeseburger, right? This is your Zen moment, if you've been waiting for it this weekend. He starts eating his cheeseburger, and I said, "Hey, man, I thought you ordered a club sandwich." Listen carefully. He said, "I did, but they brought me a cheeseburger." I said, "Brother, you don't have to live like that." I said, "We can write this horrible, right? This ain't lack of power, yeah, but we can get a damn club sandwich over here, right?" And I'm calling people over, and he's going, "No, Steve, man, I'm okay." He said, and the thing is, he wasn't just eating the damned old cheeseburger because that's what they had brought him. He was fine with the cheeseburger. And it would have been okay to say, "You know what, I ordered a club sandwich. Would you guys get that?" And they would have gone and gotten it, and none of that would have been, that would have been okay. But wasn't his life easier? And because he was okay with the cheeseburger. And what I'll tell you is I go through life ordering a club sandwich and getting a cheeseburger, and it ain't okay. I go through life waiting for you, the world, to get my order right. And I hadn't even placed my order. You know, I don't even know what I really want. But I know whatever you're bringing is not the right meal. You know what I mean? And so that silly little analogy that truly has stuck with me for that time was, it, can I find a way to go through, and I don't mean being abusive relationships and that type of stuff, but that's 99% of my stuff is not that stuff. 99% of my stuff is being limited by making demands that I don't know I'm making on the world. It's requiring things to be a certain way for me to be okay. And I think it came up maybe in one of the workshops or somebody else talked about it, but what I realize is I'm spending all my time getting ready to have a good day. When? As soon as. As soon as I'm more spiritually fit. As soon as I'm making a couple more bucks. As soon as my daughter straightens her life out. As soon as my wife treats me a little different. As soon as this job thing clears itself up. As soon as you guys, you know, what? As soon as it gets colder or hotter or starts raining or quits raining, some level of something that I think I need. And so I was in a meeting. I was about 30 days sober, six, maybe 60, 30 days out of treatment. And there's a brand new guy in the room, small little meeting, and everybody's trying to give little a pitch and encourage him, because he was literally wearing bandages, came in bandaged up. And they said, "Man, keep coming back. It gets better." And next person gave a little pitch, said, "Keep coming back, man, it gets better." Three, four, five people, "Keep coming back, man, it gets better." And there's an old guy, Herb, in the meeting there at 202, and I won't use his language, but he says, I tell you when it gets better. It gets better when it's okay the way that it is. Man, my head was spinning like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, you know? Oh. What kind of Jedi is this Herb guy? And, But that's kind of the deal, right? I keep waiting. I don't know that I've got these demands, you know, and they're in ink, and they're permanent, and I don't even know it. And that's what the process of these steps, among other things, continually loosens those bonds, relieves me of that bondage of self. You know, that third step prayer says, relieve me of the bondage of self. For years, I had this vision of self being held hostage. Self is the hostage taker. Self is comprised in AA, the ego. We are egocentric rather than God-centric. So my view of life goes through that prism as I started, of fear and pride and jealousy. And that's what that colors my view of the world. It informs my experiences of the world. And can I get those closer down to their right size to where I can now see clearly? And that's what this process does. That's what you guys do for me. I usually spend more time on this last thing, but I'll just end with that relationship with God that I struggled with. I've now found something that works for me. And I kind of view God, it's just my own personal deal or this power as... You know, it says that we each of us in our personal stories describes in his own languages from his own point of view how he established a relationship with God. So it's the relationship we talk about, not God. How do I relate to God? My own point of view. What does it look like from here? What does God look like from my point of view? Doesn't mean it's the only one. Everybody here looked out their window this weekend, had a little different point of view. So you were seeing a little something else or seeing a different angle of it. So what's my point of view? I take the point of view that God doesn't do anything to me or for me, that this power does what the power does, and my job is to get plugged into the power. And that I get plugged into that power by removing those things that block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Bob talked about it last night in little different language, but if that God is deep within, as I relate to God, deep within every man, woman, and child, our book says, but look out, it'll be obstructed, obscured by pomp, pride and ego, worship of other things, those demands, calamity. Calamity can be that bankruptcy, it could be death, it could be illness, or I can get home and the shows that I tried to record on my DVR might not have recorded. And because a calamity is anything I've decided can't be happening to me. And that will also, when I get afraid, I get blocked off from God. When I get greedy, when I worship that money, when I place that relationship higher than my relationship with God, then I'm cut off from God. I'm flying solo. And I got to tell you, what I look like, I'm plugged into that power, but I'm like that bad lamp you've got at your house that kind of, you know, it's got a bad connection, so it blinks on and off during the day, you know. I'm connected for a little while, I'm not. I'm trying to stay longer. And pay attention to it. And what God looks like for me here in AA was brought to me through a little poem that a guy named Mo Holleran back in Nashville used to always close his talks with. And Mo came down with cancer in 2003. I'd first heard him use the poem in 1997. He was a great mentor to me in Nashville, not a sponsor. But Mo, I asked Mo at breakfast if I could start closing my talks with the verse to that poem because it absolutely described my experience in AA. And he was embarrassed, but he said, if you think it'll help another drunk, Steve. And then he died 6 weeks later. And it has helped me every time that I have recited it. So that's the drunk that matters, right? And he said, the poem was, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what you guys have done for me. You let me share my life with you here this weekend a little bit. You share your life with me. This power shows up in a way that I can't define or comprehend. but has kept me 100% sober since June the 30th of 1989. And most of the time when I'm willing and surrendered allows me a life that's happily and usefully whole. Thanks so much for having me.